This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. We're going to talk today about what's called food insecurity. In a nutshell, to be food insecure means either occasionally or often you don't know where your next meal is coming from. The Department of Agriculture reports that almost 11% of U.S. households are food insecure, and 4% of households had very low food security. And those figures come from 2006. One has to wonder what 2008 will hold for us and hold for Americans who from time to time or frequently don't have enough food. On March 14th of this year, 2008, the Labor Department announced that grocery costs had jumped more than 5% in the space of a year. Milk up 17%, cheese up 15%, bread up 12%, and eggs up 25%. Our guest this afternoon is activist Mark Winnie. Since the 1970s, he's worked to address the problems of food insecurity and hunger. This afternoon, we'll talk with him about what he's learned. Mark Winnie is the author of Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. Winnie reports early in the book that the food gap includes not only food insecurity, but also includes the overconsumption of food. That is, eating too much of the wrong thing and too little of the right thing. Winnie says, quoting here, "Hunger, food insecurity, poverty, and overweight obesity often have overlapping associations and connections." In this portion of the program, we'll delve into the causes for the food gap with the help of Mark Winnie. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion. We look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. For many years, Mark Winnie was the executive director of the Hartford Food System in Hartford, Connecticut. He now writes, speaks, and consults on topics involving community food systems. His book, Closing the Food Gap, is published by the Beacon Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mark Winnie, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me, Celeste.
My pleasure. I mentioned the recent jumps in food prices in my introduction. Is it safe to say we could see a jump in the number of people who will find it a challenge to put food on the table, and are we prepared to meet the need?
I think that we should expect to see higher rates of food insecurity in the coming year. Prices are going up, as you mentioned, and at the same time, we have other economic factors that I think we're becoming all too aware of, including higher unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these are all factors that are going to affect food security, which is very much influenced by money. That's really what it comes down to. Do I have enough money to buy food? And what is the price of the food that is available?
Yeah. What does the term food security encompass?
Well, food security is the ability of a family to buy or otherwise secure enough food to meet their basic nutritional needs. It's fairly simple. You know, it doesn't always mean that you're going to be buying it from a conventional source like a supermarket. Sometimes it means going to a food bank to get your food. And in a few cases, it's people who are able to grow their own. But for the most part, it simply means that, you know, that whole sort of unpredictability and risk associated with someone who's poor and just doesn't know where their next meal is coming from is diminished by the fact that you have the means to buy food.
Yeah. Well, the issue of poverty is at the heart of this. And to the question, is it possible to eliminate poverty, you say yes. How do we go about it?
Well, people love to ask me that question. Unfortunately, I usually leave them wanting. The problem here is not so much what is the plan to end poverty. It's when do we start talking about poverty again and making those plans. We have really through our, you know, I don't blame hunger programs per se, food banks, the food stamp program. We're spending something like $55 billion a year of federal funding on food programs like food stamps. You know, these programs are a necessary safety net to prevent food insecurity. However, because we have placed such an emphasis on them, we have not placed any emphasis or any significant emphasis on ending poverty. We think that if we can mitigate poverty's worst effect, which is namely hunger and food insecurity, that's enough. And I don't happen to believe that's the case. I think that the time is right for us to re-engage this question of poverty. I think we are hearing it a little bit in this year's political campaign. And I think we need to get back into that discussion again, because otherwise we're going to be addressing hunger and food insecurity way, way into the many decades into this century.
Mm. How good is the safety net at the moment?
It's okay, you know, but consider this, that we have the food stamp program, which is the most important piece of the safety net in terms of food, and also it's one of the most significant parts of our overall welfare system in this country. But the food stamp program really only provides about $1, maybe it's $1.05 per meal per person. That's really not enough for anyone to live on. And as a result, people who are using food stamps will, you know, get to about the third week of the month, and then they have to look for other sources. And oftentimes those are food banks and food pantries or soup kitchens or other places, you know, that provide free or emergency food. There's many difficulties in the way that our food programs operate, either not enough money, not enough people who are actually eligible for those programs take advantage of them. There's sometimes some inefficiencies and sloppiness in the way they're run. But for the most part, they're necessary at this point in time until we're able to more effectively address poverty.
Mm. Over time, as you've been active in this area, you've come to see some flaws in emergency food programs, and you write about it in Closing the Food Gap. You also wrote an op-ed piece on the subject that appeared in the Washington Post. And in the book, one of the things you say is this: while activists are occupied feeding people, they may not be trying to achieve funding for solving the underlying problems of food insecurity. This gets it back to poverty. And in the op-ed piece, you say there is codependency within the system. You want to talk about those issues?
Yes. Let's look at a few examples, and I'll draw on my experience in Connecticut, where I ran a food program for 25 years, and that included the founding of the state's largest food bank. And in the early 1980s, we only had in our community of Hartford, Connecticut, the state's capital, four or five places where people could get food, free food, emergency food. And these were mostly your old line settlement houses and mission organizations and societies that had been around for 100 years. Today in Hartford, we have almost 400 such places. You know, that's a 100-fold increase over what we had just 25 years ago. And I asked the question, why do we have this many programs, this many places where people can get free and emergency food? And why have we allowed this system to develop in this country and, in fact, have accepted it as normal, as sort of, you know, just part of the landscape, when, in fact, it really didn't exist in any significant way 25 years ago? And I've seen food banks become very dominant institutions communities all across the country during this period of time. It's very frequently, almost all your major food banks have been engaged in almost continual expansion programs. They've increased their size. They've gone, made their warehouses bigger and better. They engage in fairly significant capital campaigns to increase their funding so that they can build more facilities. And I think that, you know, they can make a pretty good case for these, for this expansion. Yet my contention is that as we've gone through this whole process of responding to emergency food programs and emergency food needs, we have neglected the political aspects, the policy aspects. Because if you recall, the main thing that changed in the early 1980s, you know, that really was the catalyst for this growth in the emergency food system, was the Reagan administration, which came into power at that time and began to significantly cut social welfare programs. And in fact, the country's whole attitude toward poverty changed at that point as well. The responsibility for meeting people's needs began to shift away from the federal government to the private charitable sector. And that's where we are today. Too much of our attention is being directed toward meeting the needs of hungry people through the resources of the private charitable sector. And as a result, we have not held government accountable during this period of time.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Mark Winnie, author of Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener in Sycamore. Line 4, hi.
Good afternoon. Yeah, you know what? This country is in a world of hurt. It's really kind of decaying slowly from the inside out. I listen to this guy, and I'm part of the kind of the group that's middle going down from middle income family down to the bottom. I think that someday we're going to have nothing but the rich versus the poor, and that's it. The food bank thing is a serious problem. What we're having is a lot of these farmers are wasting crops. If you look even down there where you're at, and the same thing here, a lot of these farmers are growing corn and soybeans and, I mean, just wheat. And the government pays them not to farm certain things. The government pays them to waste things. I've heard of this, and this is the same thing with dairy farmers, waste milk, basically pour milk out, get paid to do that, which I think is ridiculous because we're... The food banks I know up here are getting loaded more and more with people that are destitute. There's more people that are losing their jobs and losing their houses because of the economy. What it comes down to is we're, as a nation, are going to be self-dependent on our government and not on ourselves, and it ought not to be the case. And I think, personally, myself, I have my own garden. And even though I'm, you know, working hard and spending a lot of time and finding myself paying more bills every year, I try to grow as many crops as I can and try to donate my crops, my excess crops, to other people or food banks because I, you know, I don't want to see anything wasted. And I'm just wondering, do you see the verge of a middle income, or just the way our economy is, people, more and more people being reliant on the government as far as the welfare benefits and more food and more, you know, displaced people? Do you see that?
Well, I think you make many, many good points. I do think that, you know, when people have no options, you know, when they're cupboard is bare, they're going to turn to the government or they're going to turn to somebody for help, especially if they have children. You know, my concern is that we need to be able to, you know, make sure that they're getting the right kind of help and that we're not going to be in the situation, you know, month after month, year after year, that there's some way that we're going to help those people get out of the situation where they never have enough resources. Now, I would like to comment on your point about you covered a lot of ground, and I think it was really interesting. And the, you know, and farmers are being paid perhaps not so much to waste food, but they certainly are being encouraged to grow food that isn't necessarily the food that we need the most or that we are actually eating directly. Billions and billions of dollars are spent every year by the government to support crop prices and provide subsidies to a very small number of farmers. And to go back to the point we made at the beginning of the show about the price of food, well, the actual price of fruits and vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables, has gone up about 40% over the last 10 years, and that's accounting for inflation. But the actual price of so-called junk food, sodas, snacky foods, your fatty, sugary snack foods, has gone down 15%. And that's largely because we subsidize a lot of those crops that, like corn and soybeans, and we do not provide any subsidy for fruits and vegetables. So, keep in mind that we have this sort of big problem that involves policies in Washington that don't often make sense in terms of what people's needs are, particularly their dietary needs. So it's a complicated picture, and I think you've helped us to understand it a little bit better.
Yeah. Also, one of the things that the caller raises is the issue of self-reliance, and I think this is something we all, most of us, all of us, prize.
I agree. Self-reliance is, a guiding principle of this country. There's no doubt about it. But I can't be self-reliant if I don't have a decent job, if I'm not making a decent income. If I was born into a family where education levels are low or education was not respected, we have become a low-wage economy. We increasingly are putting our workers into Walmarts, retail service economy, and we are losing manufacturing jobs that were traditionally paid good wages to people. I always think the story of Henry Ford, who paid his workers enough so that they could actually buy a car that they were making on his factory line, assembly line, is something that we should be looking for in all of our workplaces in this country, yet that's increasingly less so. The wages that are being paid by many of your large retailers in this country are not enough to keep people, they're low enough so that those workers are often eligible for the food stamp program.
Yeah. Well, wages is part of the equation, so too housing costs.
Yes.
And I would also say health care has got to be part of the puzzle.
You're right. Now, you add all these things up, and if I can cut corners with my food budget, I will do that. Or I think maybe what we see too often is that people are taking their limited dollars that they have budgeted for food, and they'll be buying high-calorie foods that are low in nutrition. And those are the things, they're cheaper. They're immediately gratifying, and they satisfy our hunger urge, but they don't provide us with the nutritional benefits that we need. And the cost of fruits and vegetables and other healthier foods being more expensive, makes that person in that who has to make that tough choice go to something that's not as good for them.
Mm. Why don't we make fruits and vegetables less expensive?
That's probably the $64,000 question. The politics of American agriculture are baffling to most of us. I think anyone who's trying to understand the current farm bill debate, which has still not been resolved, we still do not have a farm bill yet in this country, something we vote on every 5 years. Anyone who tries to understand that will probably have to have a PhD in agricultural economics. We just have not, for the most part, have not decided that we want to make our farm policies in sync with our dietary and health policies. We have chosen, as I said before, to subsidize crops that are not the ones that are directly consumed by Americans. They're usually used for processing. They often are used for feeding animals. Increasingly, they're going to be used to produce energy. And we have not subsidized, which is a way of making these healthy foods less expensive. We have traditionally chosen not to subsidize them. And again, this is a reflection of the fact that we don't think about agriculture as a way of actually helping us meet our health and dietary goals in this country. You know, the U.S. Department of Agriculture tells us to eat between 5 and 9 servings a day of fresh fruits and vegetables. And something like less than 20% of us come anywhere close to meeting that requirement. And this is even more difficult for people who are on limited budgets. So, you know, we have to harmonize these two goals of trying to help our farmers at the same time that we're helping our citizens eat well.
Yeah. In the second chapter of the book, you introduce readers to a woman you identify as Alice M. And you met her in 1983. She was 79 years old. Tell us about her and her challenges in terms of what it was like for her to get good food and get it on the table.
Well, Alice is, you know, was somebody I knew and who represented a lot of the challenges, or had within her life a lot of the challenges that many people living in a city have, and particularly the elderly. She was living on a fixed income, basically Social Security. Her expenses were generally either very close to or even above, in some cases, her monthly Social Security check. And she lived as close to poverty as you can imagine. But she had an additional challenge, which a lot of urban residents have, in that she could not get to an affordable food store because they had, for the most part, abandoned the neighborhoods where Alice lived. And this was another feature of the food gap, that the poor people living in communities, urban communities, and we even find this in increasingly in rural communities as well, are no longer well served by the major chain supermarkets, you know, that we generally regard as the best places and the most common places to buy our food. They're the places that, you know, have usually the lowest prices. They have the best selection. They have good quality produce, for instance. And those, starting in the 1970s, those stores started to leave urban America, particularly lower-income urban America. And people like Alice didn't have a place to shop. And she did not own a car. She was too old to drive. A taxi was expensive. And public transportation, such as it was, did not do a very good job of taking her to a food store. In that particular case, she would have to change the bus twice in order to get to a supermarket that was about 3 miles away. So, you know, we call this, or I called it, supermarket abandonment. But I also, it's also been referred to, these communities have been referred to as food deserts, places where we do not find a good, affordable food stores very easily. And increasingly what we find is fast food places, convenience food stores, you know, oftentimes involving just, you know, selling gasoline and you know, convenience food products. Those are the choices that people have, and oftentimes those are the choices that poor people have.
And when you met Alice, it was 1983. 25 years later, where are we?
The situation is worse in terms of the abandonment of inner city America by supermarkets. We do have some good examples where supermarkets have come back into the city. But I'll note that, again, in my case, in my example of Hartford, Connecticut, at the time that just before I came to work there in the 1970s, there were 13 chain supermarkets operating there. Today, there is one, and it's located on the very edge of town, really much more conveniently located to the suburbs. You'll find this situation very common across America. Now, we do have some good examples of communities where, and even supermarkets that have kind of come back into the city. They've decided that, you know, yes, there is a market there. People do have money, and they need to make a reinvestment in those communities. One of the best examples in the country is in Pennsylvania, where the Pennsylvania State Legislature passed or created a fund about 3 years ago to provide some public funding to be matched by private funding and private investment to help food stores relocate to underserved urban and rural areas, these so-called food deserts. And this has been a model program that's produced something like 1 million square feet of new retail grocery space in areas that were poorly served, if at all. And in the course of doing that, creating these new food stores or expanding existing ones, they've also created about 2,500 new jobs. And oftentimes these are well-paying jobs. So it's a good example of how public investment can make a difference in one very significant aspect of the food gap.
Mark Winney is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, author of Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign County, line one. Hi.
Hi. Yes, you just covered, Jeff, my question about the availability of food in urban areas where people have the most need and are most subject to this food deficit. But the other flip side of that is even if they could get the food, a lot of particularly the younger generation don't know how to cook it if they could get it. Are we going to teach people how to economically consume quality food products? I mean, it might cost you $3 for a Swanson's chicken dinner, but you can buy a whole chicken to make chicken soup with that. So I'd like to hear your comment, please.
No, you make a very good point. It's certainly a problem. You know, we have a whole generation of young people that cuts across different income lines that do not know how to cook, don't know how to prepare food, don't know how to shop for food. Now, there's different places to put the blame. You know, one is that we have a incredible growth in fast food. You know, more and more people eat out at places where that are relatively cheap and provide at least a satisfying meal, though not necessarily a healthy one. Our schools, on the other hand, have also, for the most part, abandoned any responsibility for teaching young people how to prepare food. I mean, home economics was a big part of the public schools where I grew up. And it was kind of interesting that only a couple of years after I graduated from high school that home economics was no longer just for girls. It was for boys, too. And I unfortunately missed out on it. But over the time, I did manage to teach myself how to prepare a decent meal. I do think that schools need to look at this question again. If we don't teach our children how to select healthy food, how to make informed decisions about the food they buy and eat, and, as you point out, how to prepare that food, then I think we're not only are we giving up on them in terms of our responsibility, but we're going to be looking at increasing costs, health care costs. Right now, obesity in this country is costing this country $117 billion a year of additional health care costs. So if we can make an investment in our children right now in our schools so that they can become competent consumers and competent cooks and even perhaps gardeners. I'd love to a gentleman who called earlier and said he is a gardener. I'd love to see schools be able to teach children at least some of the basics of gardening. Grow a tomato plant or something pretty easily and understand how that works. So, yes, I think that schools are a way that we need to begin to prepare children once again to be competent food citizens and consumers. I think we need to look at the larger environment and this food environment, which which means, aren't there maybe too many fast food places out there? Don't we make it a little too easy? And maybe we are advertising that is encouraging young people to eat a Big Mac or go to Mickey D's a little too often. Doesn't that maybe need to be curtailed? I think some of these societal factors and some of the areas of responsibility that educators have need to be looked at very carefully.
Yeah, it's interesting when you go to a fast food place, it's more expensive to selectively pick from the menu than it is to buy a packaged meal, you know what I'm saying, with a certain size soft drink and a certain size fries and a certain size sandwich, that kind of thing. If you selectively choose the healthiest options there, one by one, it costs you a lot more than to buy the super duper, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are schools now that are doing gardens, which I think is very interesting. And I wonder if we might see a return to home ec. And this also leads me to the question of what do our school lunch programs look like today?
Well, it's a source of enormous debate.
Yeah.
Our food in our schools and the cafeterias have been criticized by many people. And I think that there, however, I would say that what you will eat today in a school cafeteria is much better than what I ate 40 years ago. Also, I think we're seeing that the health and nutrient value of most of the food has increased substantially because, in particular, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has established requirements and minimum standards for the food that's being served. At the same time, however, they're not providing the schools with enough money. About 60% of our children are participating in the school lunch program, meaning that they're either paying nothing for lunch or they are paying a reduced fee because of their income. And the reimbursement the schools receive for that food is about $1 per meal. That's for the food itself, the food costs. And again, like the food stamp program, how much food can you get for $1? Can you create a meal out of $1's worth of food? And it's a struggle. I know many food service directors in schools who, work incredibly hard and are, in my opinion, geniuses because they turn out, quality meals with so little resources. But it's a struggle, and it's going to become more of a struggle now that the cost of food is increasing. So, I think the quality of food is suffering in our schools, largely because we're not giving our food service people enough resources in order to buy food. I tend to think that this sort of says we don't care that much about our children. If we're not going to spend enough food so that they can eat a really high quality meal in school, it sort of says that feeding our children well is not a high priority, and that disturbs me.
Mm. Let's take we got a couple of other callers who would like to speak with you this afternoon. Next we go to Atwood Line 2. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'd just like to make a comment or clear something up that was said earlier by the earlier gentleman. He said that farmers were paid not to produce, and that's incorrect. In the mid-90s, under the Freedom to Farm Bill, farm program, farmers were stopped paying not to produce. And for the last 10 years, we have been all-out production, which has kept our commodity prices below production cost until we started making fuel out of it. But we are not being paid not to produce. That stopped in the mid-90s under Freedom to Farm.
Okay, well, thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's go on and take another call. A listener on line 3, Champagne. Hi.
Hello. You've addressed this in some of your earlier comments, but I wonder if you could just put together your thoughts. If you encounter some of our contemporary Reaganites that still uphold his domestic policies. How do you respond to someone who says to you, if we continue using government policy to address poverty, we will continue to go down the road toward a nanny state or a social welfare state and undermine personal responsibility besides in the society? So the argument goes, anyone can pull themselves up by the bootstraps if they just try, and if we undermine that, we create a moral hazard of undermining precisely the kind of entrepreneurialism that caused hungry people in the past to create options. And I don't subscribe to that, but I've run into this in multiple policy debates that I've had, and I'm just wondering, how do you respond to that general? And I'll hang up and listen.
First of all, we're not trying to provide more welfare to people. Don't forget, President Clinton said we're ending welfare as we know it. However, he didn't say we're ending poverty as we knew it. I don't think that helping somebody to be trained for a good job, to get a good job, means that we are now in a nanny state. I don't think that dealing with the enormous problems of our health care and health insurance system means that we're headed for the nanny state. I don't think that providing child care to a working mother who's trying to go to school to improve herself or to be trained in how to get a good job is, again, an example of the nanny state. We're trying to help people get up, pull themselves up by the bootstraps, become self-reliant, but we're not talking about just providing more welfare, to pay somebody to not work. That's not what this is about. But unless we begin to look at effective strategies to end poverty, like I just described, then we're going to be stuck in this kind of welfare mentality. We're going to be stuck in having to provide food for people forever and a day.
And let's take one more call. I believe our Sycamore listener has something else to add. Line four, go ahead.
Yeah, I like this guy. I hope there's a website or something I can contact you with, because I have a whole bunch of ideas for you. The reason I say this is because I learned, you were talking about the when they used to have in school, in high school, home. Well, I didn't have home ec, but I did have forestry, botany classes and whatnot, and it taught me a little bit, and that's where I learned my gardening experiences from. And it's overwhelming nowadays. I could save myself hundreds, almost thousands of dollars in going to the store, especially during the summer and this fall, from buying tomatoes and, whatnot, throughout the year. And I'm just now converting it for the winter. And I highly urge people do this. It's a fun project, too. And there are projects out there where you can do this cheaply and safely. And I just had to throw this out there. I kind of disagree, with I think we ought to be more self-reliant. Again, like I said earlier, I think there's too many people out there nowadays that take advantage of the system in the wrong way, and it kind of hurts the people that actually need it. But when you go this route, I think you're, like the food bank that we have out here up where I'm at, they do a great job of trying to, get the word out and help the people in need. And I just think that more households around the country could do a lot in their own backyard, just in pots. There are so many things out there in all the chain stores that you can get information on. It's just overwhelming. So I just had to throw that out there. And thanks again. Great stuff.
Okay. Thanks for the call this afternoon.
Yeah, I would say that, I'm an avid gardener myself and save hundreds, if not thousands of dollars on my food because I buy it myself. And I also don't have to pay fees to a fitness center in order to stay healthy.
Yeah.
I get my exercise working in the garden. but let's remember that it's not for everybody. And not everybody has a nice backyard or even a community garden that they can go to. Which is something to think about, too. If we're going to promote gardening and growing your own, which I avidly support, let's think. think what it takes, you know, in order to train somebody to do that. You know, it's not something that I've seen a lot of people say, yeah, I'm going to go off and start a garden and think they know how to do it, and they fail miserably, and they're so discouraged they never try it again. So let's make sure that people have some help, some know-how, some resources to do it well.
Yeah. Among the positive things you identify in closing the food gap are farmers markets and community-supported agriculture. There are some farmers markets and some CSAs benefiting people with low incomes. And this takes a little bit of effort, but how does it work?
Well, as we know, farmers markets have become very prevalent, and I think that's very good news. When I was starting up in the 1970s, we had no more than perhaps a couple of hundred farmers markets across the entire country. We had none in Connecticut, where I was working at the time. And today, there's over 4,500 farmers markets across the country and over 90 farmers markets in the state of Connecticut. We actually started the very first one in the late 70s. And I think everyone realized these are great places. We can get in touch with farmers. We can get some of the best food that's available anywhere in our area. They liven up downtown areas. They're attractive. They're just entertaining places to visit. But we often found that, lower-income families struggle to shop there,
mm-hmm.
sometimes because the prices were higher, sometimes because the farmers' markets were not that accessible to where they lived. One thing we did to kind of close the gap there was start a program that's called the Farmers Market Nutrition Program. And this is a joint federal-state-funded effort that provides coupons to low-income moms and senior citizens to buy fresh produce at farmers' markets. Nice little program, and I emphasize little, only gets about $35 to $40 million of support every year. Compare that to the billions that are spent on the crop subsidies that we were discussing earlier. So it would be good to see that program increase so that people could buy more fresh fruits and vegetables at farmers' markets. In the case of community-supported agriculture, it's a little more difficult, but through the goodwill of many supporters from faith communities to Rotary clubs to Boy Scouts to just people of compassion, we've been able to provide some help to low-income families to join and be members of community-supported agriculture farms. There's been a lot of inventive, creative ways that people have found to make sure that those CSAs are as inclusive as possible, that they're not just serving the affluent foodie shoppers of a particular community, but that they're there for everybody. And it's a little harder because these are farms that are run by private farmers, and they have got to make a buck.
Mm-hmm.
So it requires a little bit of charitable support from all sectors in order to make sure that those lower-income families can join as well.
Yeah. So does that mean like people coming together and putting together the cost of a share or several shares?
Yes, that's one way. I mean, sometimes people will kick in an extra $10 when they buy their own share, and that $10 goes into a fund to help a lower-income family join. Or a church will, instead of, or maybe in addition to holding a canned food drive, ask everyone to bring in $10, and we're going to buy a share or two for a low-income family to be a member of the CSA. Sometimes there's some government support that has been able to help help achieve the same thing. I've seen groups schools that have put on fundraisers to raise money so that families can join a CSA. What I like about that, frankly, is that the community gets involved. This is really the best food available. This is the healthiest stuff that you can get. And it's much better to get that, particularly in season, than to be eating, canned green beans.
Yeah. There, we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Mark Winnie, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
My pleasure. Mark Winnie, author of Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. Our guest's name is spelled W-I-N-N-E. For many years, he was the executive director of the Hartford Food food system in Hartford, Connecticut. He now writes, speaks, and consults on topics involving community food systems. His book, Closing the Food Gap, is published by the Beacon Press. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, you're tuned to The Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We hand things off now to Todd Gleason. He has settlement prices for us now from the Chicago Board of Trade and Kansas City as well, Todd.
Indeed, settlement prices and every contract in the 2008 months, at least, at the Chicago Board of Trade for wheat, corn, soybeans, all down the limit today. The only thing actually even close was May bean meal. It didn't finish off the limit, but it was pretty darn close. It was $19.80 lower. That's just 20 cents off the $20 limit move in the May bean meal futures. Let's take a look at how things did finish up. We'll start in the wheat pit. Soft red down the 90-cent limit. Remember, an expanded limit after yesterday's trade. At this point, $11.70 was the high, the low at $10.74, and a settlement price at $10.74, down 90 for the day. July futures, $11.39 the high, the low at $10.48, settled on that low, down 90. And September's, $11.43 the high, the low in the settlement price, down the limit, 90 lower at $10.55. March contract in the soft red winter wheat pit, 90 lower there. But had a high of $11.62. And their settlement price was at $10.72. I've got a different low, but it's got to be $10.72 on the low, down 90 cents for the day. Corn futures, May contract of 548 and three quarters high, low at 527 and a quarter, settled on that low, down 20 cents. July futures off 20 as well, 561 the high, the low in settlement price. Limit lower at $5.39 and one quarter in July. Corn down 20, September down 20. 541.5 was the settlement and the low price, the high at 561.5. And December futures, a 562.25 top, bottom, and settlement price at $5.41.25, down the limit for new crop December corn, 20 cents lower today. March futures, 570.75 the high, the low and limit move for the settlement at 549.25, down 20, and May futures for next year at 570 on the top, the low and the settlement price at 552. A December 09 contract was limit lower as well, 518.5, the low in the settlement price there, at a high price of 537 and one half. May oats down 20 cents at 358 today, July at 367, down 20. Soy complex now, nearby May soybeans, 50 cents lower today, $13.15.5 the high, the low in the settlement price, down the 50 cent limit at $12.57 for the lead option May soybean futures in Chicago. July contract, $13.30 and three quarters the high, the low in the settlement price at $12.72, down 50. August futures, $13.17 the high, the low at $12.66, settlement price down on that low at $12.66, 50 cents lower. In September futures, $12.93.25 the high, the low at $12.40, settlement price down the 50 cent limit at $12.40 for the day. November soybeans, $12.48. For the high, the low in the settlement price at $11.90, down 50 on the day. And January futures, $12.51.25 the high, the low at $12.01. That was also the settlement price, down 50 for the March. And next year's November at 2009, $11.85.75 the high, the low at $11.30, settlement price at $11.30, down 50 cents. May bean meal futures, $3.35.30 the high, the low at $3.10.50, settlement price at $3.10.70, down $19.80 for the day. July futures down the $20 limit at $315.70. May bean oil, $58.40, two lower, and July futures at $59.14. They were down the $2 limit for the day as well. That's a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade. Celeste Quinn will be along in a moment with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Stay with us this afternoon during the closing market report. We'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, about what happened in Chicago. I'm Todd Gleason.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Now let's take a look at the livestock contracts and how they fared today in Chicago at the Merck. April live cattle, 90.75 the high, 89.60 the low, 89.62 and a half the settlement, that down 132 and a half. June, 91.25 the high, 89.80 the low, 89.95 the settlement, that down 155. August, 94.65 the high, 93.75 the low, 93.97.5 the settlement, that down 90. October, $100 even the high, 98.90 the low, 98.92.5 the settlement, that down 145. March feeder cattle, 99.50 the high, 99.25 the low, 99.35 the settlement, that down 10. April, 102.55 the high, 101.70 the low, 102.15 the settlement, that down 37.5. May, 105.30 the high, 104.20 the low, 104.95 the settlement, that down 67.5. August, 109.40 the high, 108.20 the low, the settlement 108.82.5, that down 50. April lean hogs, 55.50 the high, 54.70 the low, 54.95 the settlement, that down 62.5. May, 67.20 the high, 65.50 the low, 66.85 the settlement, that up 17.5. June, 71.55 the high, 70.15 the low, 71.12.5 the settlement, that down 47.5. And July, 74.80 the high, 73.45 the low, the settlement 74.70, that down 70 cents. And May bellies, 75.70 the high, 73.65 the low, the settlement 74.55, that down 197.5. The Dow is currently down 150 at 12,243, the NASDAQ off 28 at 2240, the S&P 500 off 16 points at 1315. You're tuned to WILL, Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Henry Frayne is our technical director today. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn. In the WILL severe weather coverage area, an urban and small stream flood warning continues in effect for Clark, Cumberland, and southern Edgar counties until 3:30 this afternoon, and a flood watch remains in effect for Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, Douglas, Edgar, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Shelby, and Vermilion counties until 4 o'clock this afternoon. The forecast for Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly cloudy, windy, and cooler with the chance of a brief shower or occasional drizzle. The high around 40. Tonight, partly cloudy and colder, the low 30. Tomorrow, intervals of clouds and sunshine, the high around 50. Let's look at the forecast for Illinois and Indiana. Flood warnings are in effect for much of southern Illinois and southwestern Indiana. Flash flood warning in effect for far southeastern Indiana. And flood watches remain in effect for southern and east central Illinois and for all of central and southern Indiana. This afternoon in northern and west central Illinois, becoming partly to mostly sunny. From southwestern through east central Illinois, mostly cloudy with a few lingering showers and areas of drizzle. In southeastern Illinois and throughout Indiana, cloudy with scattered showers. Highs ranging from 38 in far northern Indiana to 52 in far southern Indiana. Tonight in southern sections and central Indiana, some lingering showers. This evening, possibly mixed with snow in central Indiana, then partly to mostly cloudy. Elsewhere, clear to partly cloudy, lows from 26 in northern Illinois to 35 in southwestern Illinois. Tomorrow in northern Illinois, partly to mostly cloudy. Elsewhere, mostly sunny early, then increasing cloudiness. Highs ranging from around 40 in northern Indiana to 62 in southwestern Illinois. More on the weather during the closing market report that's coming up next here on AM 580. Stay tuned.